It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
I want you to know I'm not getting a flu shot this year.
Oh, good.
Good.
Because, boy, you were typhoid Joff last year when you did.
That's true. It didn't work very well, did it?
Nope.
Maybe for you it did, but...
No, I thought that was kind of hilarious in the debates. Bush was so noble about it.
Oh, that's one thing we didn't even put down. We had our final debate this week, but maybe we should just skip that.
I didn't really have anything to say about it.
Okay. No, there wasn't a whole lot new in that debate. It was one of those things where you just kind of watch it and you think, you know, it's time to bring in some other candidates. You know, I think I was thinking that about the time the second debate happened, that why don't we have Ralph Nader up there and David Corn and the guy who was running on the Libertarian side, just so that we could, you know, get a few different viewpoints in there.
David Cobb. David Corn's a
David
correspondent
Cobb,
for the Nation.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
early. What can I say?
The debates are set up as bipartisan rather than nonpartisan. They're really designed to serve the two major parties, and it totally shuts out candidates from other parties, and it is designed to, you know, allow the candidates to use as much of their stump speeches and their tried and true sort of boilerplate as they can, and it gets boring after a while. Mm.
Yeah. Also, the format was very, very frustrating. I mean,
yes.
people complained that there weren't a lot of details in any of the answers that the candidates gave. But how many details can you give in 2 minutes or 90 seconds or a 30-second follow-up? There just isn't time.
Yeah.
I had watched, I went to C-SPAN archives for video and had checked into the, in New Hampshire, they actually have a forum where all the third-party candidates get to speak. And there was like... In the Democrats, there was like 20-something, and I didn't see the Republican one, which I understand there was about 15. And you're like watching these people. They're just everyday people like you and I. And out of like, I'd say 80% of them, you go through and you go, this guy's better than what we got now. Yeah, this guy's better than what we got now. I mean, it's just fascinating. And it's just so sad that that doesn't get a, you know, major coverage so that we see these alternatives. Mm-hmm. And,
yeah, I remember going to the FEC, Federal Election Commission, website a few months ago during the primary season and looking at the list of who'd filed as a presidential candidate, and there were like, you know, 400 of them. And it made for fascinating reading because they had background on all these different people. And, you know, some of them were obviously cranks, but some of them were, you know, seemed to have a lot to say.
Yeah. Our system of exclusion. So we're hearing news that there's major oil shortages, but out on Puget Sound, that's
no.
Not the case.
No, it's a spill that's in its second day now. It's happened sometime overnight, early Thursday morning. And this is not the type of thick, gooey, black crude oil that was spilled in the Exxon Valdez. It's more like motor oil, but it is spread onto the beaches of Vashon and Maury Island, heading up toward Alki probably sometime today. That's the direction the current is going. And the kicker in all this is we don't know yet who the tanker was that spilled the oil. Now, it's virtually impossible, given the safety checks and the gauges and everything else, for the crew of one of these tankers not to know that oil has been discharged. And there has been a problem on the West and East Coast both with intentional discharges of this type of oil from the engine room. So there is the possibility that this was an intentional release, which is really quite worrisome.
Also, a problem with this spill, too, was the amount of time it took for
yes.
state officials to get boats out there to assess the size of the spill, the type of oil, and to get cleanup started.
Yep.
It took about 8 to 9 hours, which is just unconscionable. I don't know how they can explain that. All I can say is that I think it must just be because there was no preparedness for this sort of thing.
Yeah, the explanation was that there was thick fog Thursday morning. But, I mean, these boats have GPS systems on them. They can navigate in fog. I don't know what kind of an excuse that is.
Yeah.
And this was relatively a very small spill compared to what we could be looking at if there's like a major tanker spill.
Yeah, although it's a much larger spill than it would have been if it had been contained all in one glob, you know, if they had gotten there much earlier. I mean, that was the problem with waiting so long to have any kind of initial
response. Is that
it spreads out. There are
strong currents.
Yeah, it spreads out. And but you're right. I mean, the kind of large industrial tankers that come to the ports of Seattle and Tacoma, you know, very often they're single thickness hulls that could very, very easily be a major spill in Puget Sound of the type that we have never really seen.
Right. So I just keep wondering how many more wake-up calls do our elected officials need, you know, and the populace need before we implement systems that can take care of this stuff. I mean, Maria, you'd spent time covering the mm-hmm. spill off of Spain, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, this has been a political football for a number of years, particularly going through the Strait of Juan de Fuca, where the Coast Guard has been fighting against demands to have tugs with some of these tankers as a safety precaution. I mean, you know, the industry objects to the cost, but what is the cost of one of these cleanup operations, both monetarily and in terms of the ecosystems? The Maury and Vashon Island beaches were protected marine areas, and the wildlife damage from this spill, even though it's not that major a spill, relatively speaking, is still quite substantial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the damage to shellfish beds. And I think people are just, they can go out with a spill like this, and they can walk on a beach very close to where they live, and they can see the actual effect of it and be totally disgusted. It's kind of one of those things where we're confronted with one of the pieces of fallout from our oil dependence. You know, and I think it's one of those things that people can look at it and say, gosh, you know, do I really need to be driving an SUV? You know, do we really need to elect a president who thinks that giveaways to oil companies and promoting the extraction of oil is the way to go in the future?
Yeah, and that global warming isn't really happening. take a little test for yourself. Go down to the beach at, you know, Lincoln Beach or Alki, and look at the tides in the tide pool one morning, and, you know, in a couple of months, and then go over to one of the affected areas on Vashon or Maury or maybe one of those areas if the current heads up this way, and look at the difference in a couple of months, because it will take quite a bit of time for the biological life in these areas to recover.
Yeah, and maybe go clamming. Hmm. Okay.
I wouldn't eat it.
Corporations, you know, they need a break, and they got one this week.
Yeah, I learned that in the debates, that the corporations are our friends.
Well, we know that the Bush administration has pushed through three tax cut bills. Now it was time for the corporations to line up for a tax cut, and the House and Senate passed corporate tax cut bill that was supposed to be to create jobs. Now, that, I think, was it supposed to be some kind of a joke, because there's nothing in this bill that would create jobs. Now, the bill that was passed was initially supposed to be to repeal the tax break for exports, for exporters, that has gotten the U.S. in trouble with the WTO. Now, the EU, the European Union, had sued a couple years back, excuse me, to have tariffs imposed on U.S. goods, because they said it was not a level playing field, because U.S. exporters got this enormous tax break from the U.S. government. Now, it's taken Congress those 2 years to come up with a bill that would replace that export tax cut. So this bill does repeal a $5 billion tax break that that exporters like Microsoft and Boeing, et cetera, had gotten every year. But what it replaces it with is a $143 billion tax cut over 10 years. So in other words, that's about $14 billion a year, almost three times the original tax cut that it's replacing. Now, the two main pieces of this bill, there's a $76.5 billion cut over 10 years, which means about $7.5 billion a year, which will lower the corporate income tax rate for manufacturers from 35% to 32%. Now, the kicker is that it's not just, not just classical manufacturers who get this tax cut. The bill expands the definition of manufacturing, to include not just companies that make a product to be sold overseas or at home, but companies that also are engineering firms. So, for example, Bechtel and Microsoft, because they are a software engineering firm, architectural firms, Hollywood studios, home builders, extraction industries, which include oil, coal, and gas companies like ExxonMobil and BP Amoco, who both very heavily lobbied for this bill to be passed. It includes electric companies, timber companies, mining companies, and even farmers can qualify as manufacturers and get their corporate income tax lowered from 35% to 32%. That's going to take $7.5 billion out of the Treasury every year, and that's the conservative estimate. Now, the other big piece of this bill is $42.6 billion per year in cuts for $42.6 billion over 10 years, so about $4 billion per year in tax cuts for companies that will repatriate their foreign profits. Now, what that means, I'm going to just describe for you. There are a lot of companies that have a lot of foreign sales. They are required by the U.S. tax code to bring those foreign profits back home and pay tax on them. However, a lot of companies have found loopholes and schemes and ways around that so that they have kept their foreign profits in foreign bank accounts. They call them the profits of foreign partnerships or foreign holding companies, and then they don't have to pay tax on them. Now, the U.S. government thought, the Congress thought, well, why don't we give them a little incentive to bring those profits back home and use the money to create jobs here? So they added this portion to this bill. However, what this does is it's actually says that the money can be brought back, but it puts no restrictions on how the money can be spent. So it doesn't say that the money that is repatriated has to be spent to create jobs. It only says that it cannot be spent on executive compensation. So it can't be turned around and paid to the CEO or the chief financial officer. So what that means is that the money can be used for anything from buying back stock to paying down debt to mergers and acquisitions, which, as we all know, often lead to job cuts, not increases in employment. Now, the companies that will benefit the most from this are pharmaceutical companies and high-tech companies, particularly software and particularly software companies. And the reason why those companies will benefit the most and were the biggest lobbyists for this bill is because they don't produce a product that has to be shipped and sold abroad. What they do is they collect foreign royalties on software code and on drug formulas that are produced much more cheaply in foreign countries and then sold. And those are their foreign profits that they need to repatriate. Now, those companies include companies like Microsoft, Intel, Oracle, etc. Now, the little tax break that they get is a one-year tax holiday where they only pay 5.25% of tax instead of the 35% that they would pay if they actually followed the law and declared that their ordinary profits for the year. They get a little tax holiday where they only pay a tiny little bit of tax on bringing those profits home. Now, there's an estimate that says conservatively that's about $500 billion sitting out there in foreign accounts that hasn't been taxed that can be repatriated under this new bill. Now, some of the companies that get the biggest benefits from this include Oracle Corp., software company that is probably going to use its repatriated profits to buy other companies out, so acquire other companies and lay people off. Hewlett Packard will probably use its money to pay down debt after it acquired the Compaq Computer Corp., has a huge amount of debt right now. Shearing Plough, the drug company, needs to pay a $500 million tax bill to the IRS because it cheated on its taxes. It also would need to pay down some debt. Bausch & Lomb, it wants to use its funds for debt reduction, stock buybacks, and acquisitions. And then economists at J.P. Morgan said, "Well, you know, there's something wrong with this picture. It's being billed as a job creation tax cut, let's actually look and see and ask some of these companies if they're going to do anything that will create jobs. So they did a little study. Economists at J.P. Morgan, they did a little study. They looked at 28 large companies that account for 25% of unrepatriated foreign profits. More than half of those companies will use the money to pay down debt and buy back their stock. Only a third of those companies will even use a portion of the money to make capital expenditures like buying equipment, etc., which might have some impact on the economy. But for the most part, this is not a job creation bill. It's a giveaway. It's a giveaway to companies to let them pay their debts and turn around and use the profits to. Oh, and by the way, they can turn around and use the money to increase dividends to their shareholders.
Yeah, and I'm even a little suspicious about the executive compensation. I mean, how hard is it to shift the money around to another category and then, you know, use money from that other category to pay for additional executive compensation? It wouldn't be that hard, I would think.
Well, let's put it this way, Job. A lot of executives at major corporations are also shareholders.
Yeah.
So if they can use the money to increase the dividend on shares, well, executives are going to get a piece of it anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
Huh, I didn't see that coverage in the news. All right, well...
Or in the debates.
Right.
And thank you for mentioning the debates again, because one of the big successes that GW mentioned was the election in Afghanistan.
Yeah, the only problem was that it wasn't a particularly big success. We had the first election in Afghanistan on Sunday, and... They're still counting the votes. Well, it'll be a while before we know what the results are. But the day of the election, the candidates other than the incumbent U.S.-appointed president, Karzai, met at the house of one of the candidates. There are about 15 of them. And all of them together jointly said they were protesting the election and wanted it reheld. Basically, they wanted this election annulled because of irregularities in the voting. In particular, the system by which it was tracked to make sure that that Afghan citizens only voted once, or as with the system to track that they only registered once, had completely broken down. The registrars, the poll workers, were supposed to be using indelible ink to mark the fingers of the voters so that, you know, they couldn't come back on the same day and vote again. Apparently, they were using ordinary marking pens, and people were just routinely erasing them and going back and voting over and over again. And this is a fairly widespread practice, not much different from what used to happen on the south side of Chicago. The vote was considered tainted by all of these opposition candidates. But at the same time, you had GW on his debate on Wednesday night saying this is a smashing success for democracy, yada, yada, yada. There wasn't the violence that was widely feared that there might be in the election. So that was definitely a positive. But at the same time, this was in many ways a charade. It was something that many Afghans took very seriously as the opportunity to go to the polls, but it was a setup to reelect and legitimize the Karzai government, and the opponents took it as such.
All right. Well, I guess that takes us to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
Now, folks who watched the presidential debates, the campaign debates, may remember George Bush mentioning a major donors conference in Japan for Iraq to try to drum up some funds to help pay for reconstruction. Well, that donors conference happened this week, and I just want to talk about it for a minute. The interim government in Iraq, the interim government, they weren't really looking for new funds for reconstruction. What they were trying to do was trying to get governments who had made pledges last year in Madrid to release the funds for reconstruction so they could be spent. Now, there was $13.6 billion pledged by major donors last year in Madrid, And almost none of that has been released and given to the interim government to be spent. About half of the pledges were in the form of loans, which can't be made until there is an elected government in place. The other half is in the form of aids and trade credits, etc., that Iraq has not been able to get their hands on for a couple of reasons. Excuse me. No money can be sent to a country where the only green zone is a few blocks inside the city of Baghdad, and the rest of the country is considered a red zone for security purposes. No one in their right mind, no government, is going to release funds to be spent inside the green zone and not in the rest of the country where it needs to be spent. In the second place, auditors have not been able to account for the $1 billion that has been spent so far by the U.S. government in Iraq, and they cannot account for the money that the Coalition Provisional Authority spent that were Iraqi oil funds, that were Iraqi funds. Nobody really knows for sure where that money was spent. So foreign governments who have pledged money for Iraq are hesitant to throw their money down a black hole and say, well, gosh, you can have it. You were so good with the money you've spent so far.
Yeah, and that was like $20 billion dollars or some outrageous sum, wasn't it?
No, I think it was closer to about 10 to 15.
Okay, but still,
but
that's quite a bit of money.
It was a lot of money that just disappeared. And nobody really knows what it was spent on. And I mean, we're talking about auditors looking at a situation in the Iraqi Ministry of Health where obviously no money's been spent to upgrade hospitals. And they're looking at checks that were written to U.S. officials, not written to the suppliers. And they're saying, this does not look right. It looks like somebody pocketed the money. So that's the kind of thing that they're looking at, the auditors are looking at when they're trying to figure out where the money went. And that's the reason why Iraq can't get any reconstruction funds. So George Bush's major donor conference was an absolute failure. Nobody really pledged to release any money. Japan said it would release $40 million, but that it could only be spent to prepare for the election in January. Iran said it would release $10 million for the same purpose, and that's all. That's all that came out of the conference. Now, I also want to talk about what's going on the ground in Iraq, something that neither of the two presidential candidates mentioned in their debates. What's going on is that the interim government is doing something that the U.S. military would not do. They've been negotiating with both the Shiite militiamen, al-Sadr's Shiite militiamen, and with Sunni insurgents. Now, the one has been successful, the other has not. The Shiite militiamen who back Muqtada al-Sadr have brokered a ceasefire agreement in Sadr City, and they have been turning in some of their heavy weaponry. And now if the interim government is allowed to continue negotiating with them, there may actually be some sort of peace agreement that comes out of it, and Muqtada al-Sadr may actually be incorporated into the peaceful political process in Iraq. However, I'm not really very optimistic about that because the negotiations with Sunni insurgents have been interrupted by the U.S. need to attack Fallujah for political purposes here in the U.S. In short, George Bush needs to get this Abu Musab al-Zarqawi guy, who he is convinced is in Fallujah, and that means a major military operation to encircle Fallujah and continue bombing it with these enormous 500-pound bombs, which are just wreaking havoc and major destruction inside the city of Fallujah. That has put a total end to the negotiations, which the interim government has been trying to do with the Sunni insurgency.
Yeah, and they've been saying that this air campaign in Fallujah is softening up for a ground attack that they're planning to try and go in the next few weeks.
I had read, I thought, where it was the most intense air campaign on Fallujah yet. Is that true?
Yes, it is.
It is. This week they ramped it up after 4 days of a ceasefire in which the interim government was negotiating with the Sunni tribal leaders in Fallujah and hoping to get them to surrender al-Zarqawi and some of his top leadership, and we're making some progress. The U.S. military just said, forget it, it's over, negotiations are done, we're just going to go the military option, and they ramped up the bombing, and they encircled the city and and set up these checkpoints so that it's very hard for people to get in and out again. And as Jav said, they're gearing up for a major assault, maybe not before the U.S. presidential election, but almost certainly after. Now, that's what's going on the ground. There's some stuff going on at the UN as well. The International Atomic Energy Agency complained this week that nuclear facilities and processing equipment have been disappearing from Iraq, according to a year-long analysis of satellite photos. Whole facilities have been dismantled. Dozens of them have gradually disappeared from satellite photos, and UN diplomats and experts say that it would have had to have been done by people who knew what they were doing, who had heavy equipment, and who wanted to preserve and sell some of these items. Now, the scary thing is that when the International Atomic Energy Agency officials approached the U.S. government and the Iraqi interim government and showed them the evidence that this material was disappearing from Iraq, and we're talking about material that has a U.N. seal on it, that it is designated as nuclear, as equipment for processing nuclear materials. That stuff is what's disappearing, okay? Now, when they approached the interim government and the U.S. government and said, why is this disappearing? Both the U.S. government and the interim government kind of scratched their heads and said, what do you mean? Nothing's changing. They were totally taken by surprise. They had no clue this was going on. That's the scary thing here.
And in some cases, I understand we're talking about disappearance of entire buildings?
Yes, entire buildings, entire facilities, dismantled and shipped away and disappeared off of the satellite photos. And it's pretty clear that nobody in the U.S. government or in the Iraqi interim government knows that it's going on. So while George Bush says, well, we invaded Iraq to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction around the world, he's lying. We invaded Iraq, and it's happening because we invaded Iraq. Proliferation of nuclear materials.
All right. Jav, very quickly, survey time. Survey says,
yeah, survey came out talking about the popularity of the United States and of John Kerry. Not surprisingly, this is 10 countries, all of which are U.S. allies, places like France and Canada and South Korea and Russia and England. In those areas, an overwhelming total favored John Kerry by 72% to 16% in France, for example.
yes. No surprise there.
No surprise there. On average, 57% said they had a worse opinion of the United States than 2 to 3 years ago, compared to only 20% that said they had a higher opinion. This is the sort of outfall of George Bush's presidency, that and this is not a surprise for anybody who's been following international opinion, that the United States is just much, much less highly thought of in the rest of the world, particularly because of Iraq and because of the administration of George Bush.
Okay. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Yeah, well, they can find it in their hearts and minds. It's but if you've come up lacking there, it's also at bookstores and cafes around town where you find free publications. It's a newspaper that comes out every couple of weeks. You also get our back issues or the current issue off the website at www.eatthestate.org. And many of us who write for it and edit and all the rest of that good stuff are volunteers, and you can do it too. Give us a call, or if you have feedback or want to donate or any of those things, voicemail rather is area code 206-903-9461.